Excellent. Everything's falling into place. Are we ready?
Yep.
Yes, sir.
All right. All right,
all right. All right,
all right. Ah, oh, wrong show.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Red alert! All crew members report to battle stations.
Red alert. Shields up.
What shields?
You Starfleet officers, now start acting like it!
Oh, it's just Garak. Plain, simple, Garak.
Dax, we might have just discovered the first stable wormhole known to exist.
The wormhole does bring them our way, doesn't it?
Everyone wants a piece of the new frontier.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
Quite a motley crew you've assembled here, Benji.
Listen to The Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast.
And here are your hosts, Andrew Leyland, Paul Spataro, and Dr. Bill Robinson.
Bloody hell. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Listen to the Prophets, the Deep Space Nine review show, where myself and my terrific co-hosts are going through every episode of the underrated Star Trek series Deep Space Nine. Today, we are up to Season 4, Episode 8, Little Green Men. I'm Paul Spataro, and I'm joined, as always, by Dr. Bill Robinson.
Hello, Epop Orc.
Eep-op-oop, isn't it? Something along those lines, I don't know.
Something like that.
Jet Screamer. And Sir Andrew Leyland.
Why are you hitting your head?
And we are once again, we have the pleasure of having Mr. David Pascarella join us.
Great to be here once again.
Great to have you, Dave. This is the episode. Actually, Dave was here for the last episode just by chance. This is the episode he wanted to be a part of.
Yes.
So I'm going to say, Dave, why do you want to be a part of this?
As I've said before, I love time travel episodes. And this one, not only is there time travel, but they land in the period of time I like the best, the 40s into the 50s. So this had all elements for me.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. And it's, well, we'll get into the merits of the episode after we've done the synopsis and all. But in the meanwhile, anybody have any Deep Space Nine or Star Trek in general news or discussions to be had?
Yeah, I think we're all caught up for the moment, unless something's happened recently, really recently.
Like in the last hour or so.
Like in the last hour.
Behind right, the curtain, so we record these back to back.
I don't think that's that much of a mystery to anybody who actually listens. to the two people who actually listen. One of which is a guest on this show right now. And we've fallen behind. We've alienated Gene. He doesn't listen anymore. I guess we might as well jump right into this. As I said, this is Season 4, Episode 8, Little Green Men. It's directed by James L. Conway. The story is by Tony Marbury and Jack Trevino. Teleplay by Ira Stephen Baer and Robert Ewart Wolfe. The guest cast includes Max Grodinchik as Rom, Aaron Eisenberg as Nog, Megan Gallagher as Nurse Garland, the great Charles Napier as Denning, Connor O'Farrell as Carlson, and James G. McDonald as Wainwright.
In 1947, in a place called Roswell,
can't keep this from the public forever,
one event shook the world.
Beings from another planet have landed on Earth.
My name is Quark. I've got a business proposition for you.
Now Quark's playing for profit in Earth's past.
I want to go home. We're not going anywhere.
Inside of a year, we'll be running this place.
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
The plot goes like this. Quark receives a shuttle that his cousin Gala has been promising him for years. He christens it Quark's Treasure, and for its maiden voyage takes his brother Ram and nephew Nog to Earth, where Nog has been accepted to Starfleet Academy in San Francisco. Quark also intends to make the trip financially profitable by smuggling a load of illicit chemosite explosive to Orion on the return voyage. As the ship nears Earth, Ram finds that due to sabotage by Gela, they are unable to drop out of warp. However, by detonating part of the unstable chemosite shipment to create an explosion, they can drop out of warp. Unfortunately, in doing so, the ship and crew are thrown back in time to July 1947 and crash land near Roswell, New Mexico. The Ferengi awake on a U.S. military base where the Americans believe them to be Martians. After Rom repairs their malfunctioning universal translators hidden in their ear canals, Quark begins negotiations with the Humans, whom he considers backwards and gullible, to sell advanced technology from the future. He brags to Ram and Nog in private that within a year we'll be running this planet, and dreams of cultivating a vast Ferengi economic empire. Unknown to the Ferengi, however, Constable Odo has stowed away aboard the shuttle with them, and as a result was thrown back in time. Using his shapeshifter abilities, Odo is able to move about the base, locating and repairing their spacecraft. He then appears as a German Shepherd guard dog in the room where the Ferengi are being held and morphs into his normal form, telling Quark that he knew about the chemosite smuggling and that they must try to preserve the timeline and not alter Earth history. Quark, Rom, and Nog then escape from custody with the help of an army nurse and her college professor boyfriend, who has been brought to the base to try to establish dialogue with the aliens. By harnessing the energy of an atomic bomb test scheduled for that morning, Ram is able to use the remaining chemosite to cause a temporal rift, which conveniently returns them home to their proper time. After dropping Nog off at Starfleet Academy, Quark has to sell the damaged spacecraft for salvage, and he, Odo, and Ram return to Deep Space Nine. As the episode ends, Odo is seen strong-arming Quark off to a holding cell to face charges of smuggling contraband. And at that point, Quark is never on the series again because he's going to serve time until the series is well over.
Hey, anybody got a cigarette? Because everybody on the show had one, at least in 1947.
Yep.
My God, it was ridiculous.
Well, I think that's the way it was, though, back then.
So wait, you're telling me they ingest this? And they know it's poison?
I like it. He was surprised that we detonate atom bombs. Yeah. So
they irradiate their own planet? And ingest tobacco? Wow, these humans. These humans.
I really enjoyed this. I thought this was a fun melding of history, or at least theoretical history, and Star Trek, and just... Really, they just, I think the actors had fun with it, and you could kind of see it in the performances. Just overall, a really enjoyable episode. But I'm curious what you boys thought. I know Dave loves it, because otherwise he wouldn't be here.
I love this episode.
Well, any show that can get Charles Napier in it, it already get bumped up a quarter or a half a point just for that, I think. Because he's been in everything.
Yeah, and he's cool. Just something about the way he carries himself, you know. It's not one of those guys who you think, oh, yeah, I wish I was like that, but you just enjoy watching him all the time.
It's like he can play that stereotypical character perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
The tough-as-nails general who's not going to put up with anything, has contempt for the president. Fantastic.
Or the country western singer in the Blues Brothers.
That's right.
The good old boys.
Tucker McElroy.
The good old Blues Brothers boys.
Blues boys band.
I love this one. I thought this one was hysterically funny in places. I think the Ferengi all have a wonderful just joy about them. Three of them all work together exceptionally well by this point anyway. So the fact when they've got such great dialogue and are playing off some great lines is really good. Charles Napier, every single person in this is a caricature of those old 1940s, 1950s sci-fi movies that I know I love. So you've got Charles Napier as the cigar chomping general, and you've got the scientist and his girlfriend, and you've got the overzealous younger military guy, and they're all played magnificently by the actors. And there's just some really genuinely funny moments, lines, delivery of lines in it that is just really, really good. And it starts at the beginning with Worf buying the Ferengi tooth sharpener at the sale that the Ferengi kids apparently have before they go out into the world and make their own way. All of that's great stuff. I mean, as well as just giving the regular cast something to do, because once they take off, they're not in it. And I love Quark's mangling of John Masefield's poem, "All I Ask Is a Tall Ship and a Hold Full of Contraband." All of that's great. And the regular Star Trek poking fun at the stuff that we do that they just find weird, like the smoking and everything else. It's just top to bottom. It's one of the best comedy episodes they've done. It's just really enjoyable all the way through it.
Did any of you get a vibe off of Nurse Garland, that she was like Edith Keeler, that she could see all the stuff that was coming?
Oh, yeah.
But there's each of the characters was apparently meant to be an homage to someone, because I was just reading on Memory Alpha, where it said, this episode was written to be an homage to 50s B-movies. Indeed, as Robert Hewitt Wolf explains, all the characters are archetypes from those movies. The sort of human nurse who sees beyond appearance, and the tough cigar-chomping general, and the sort of traitorous mid-level military officer, and the noble scientist. And it was just, like, so much fun to play with all those archetypal science fiction characters, sort of to give a nod to the original series, but sort of to give a nod even beyond the original series, but a nod to all these great movies from the 50s, which made Star Trek possible in the first place. So everybody is meant to kind of have that feel of, I don't even want to say stereotypical characters, but I guess you'd almost say like stock characters, that there's, you know.
Yeah.
But they don't play as paper thin. I would say the closest to that is the nurse character does kind of buy into believing them very, very quickly. I would think everybody would be a little bit more skeptical at these Ferengi or Martians, as they think they are, that just show up on, you know, just there'd be a fear factor to it. I don't know that
she seems to have that motherly instinct, though, or you just, you know, kind of break. Seems to convey that, although Nog really likes her rubbing his lobes.
Yeah. did you not think that was a little bit, given what we know about their ears?
Yeah.
She's essentially wanking him off on prime time.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was hilarious.
And then Aram.
I think my ears hurt too.
It's probably the only Star Trek episode where you almost get a double hand job. It's quite remarkable.
With a father and a son. Ew.
Oh, dear me.
I think I need to go throw up now.
I'm gonna bring us back a little bit on it and just say, I'm going to read another thing from Memory Alpha. The scene where all the humans observing the Martians behind the one-way mirror were smoking was a deliberate commentary on the use of tobacco in the 1940s. Indeed, the studio was originally against having anybody at all smoking in the episode, but Ira Stephen Baer pointed out that they couldn't do an homage to 50s B-movies without seeing the characters smoke a lot. In particular, he cites the 1951 Sam Neufield movie Lost Continent as taking cigarette smoking to an unprecedented extreme. According to Baer, you see smoking in 50s movies all the time, from war movies to Bogart monster films. But Continent took it to an art form that is jaw-dropping to watch. Every time there's a problem, everyone just starts handing out cigarettes.
Gonna calm everybody down.
Baer wanted to have Quark become addicted to cigarettes and have to learn to do without. That kind of that could have been a fun subplot if they had done that.
I need some cigarettes.
You could have continued that a few episodes down.
Yeah, he's in his withdrawal.
But I think Quark would smoke cigars.
Yeah. Yes. Definitely. Cuban cigars and smuggled over the neutral zone. Yeah, I mean, what did you think of the surprise appearance by Odo?
I knew he was in the episode, but I couldn't remember his reveal. Mm. So even when the dog jumped up, I was kind of like, I don't remember, why is this dog? It's Odo. Okay.
It made sense. It didn't feel like a cheat because Odo would be suspicious of them. I don't know if he necessarily would come along for the ride if he didn't know what was going on, but they say he did know what's going on, so that's fine.
And I love the treatment of the techno babble, which Iris Stevenbo was never a fan of. So you've got Rom talking all that drivel about venting plasma and the chemosite and whatever that stuff was called, and then Quark just undercutting it by saying, I've got no idea what you're saying.
And then he brings it back at the end where he says, forget it, they'll never understand.
Yeah.
So it's good that they're taking the mick out of all the techno babble stuff. I mean, it's generally just a supremely entertaining show, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. From a logic point of view, it does always bother me in time travel things when they're able to just pinpoint and get exactly back to the point where they left.
Hmm.
You know, it just seems like it's so rare that, oops, we made a mistake and we're 2 weeks ahead or something. You know, that never happens.
Well, they did that. Didn't they do that in the original series? I think one of the times when they were spiraling towards the planet, didn't they, like, pop back up? Like, they went back in time. That's what they did.
The naked time.
Yeah. Yeah, but that wasn't a strictly time travel one. That was like a side effect of what they did. So, my bad. That wasn't a straight-up time travel show.
Mm. Now, they have 2 hours to 2 weeks to live again, didn't they?
Yeah.
They went back in time a couple of weeks further. Speaking of going back in time, and the last time David was on the show, when we covered past tense, there's a lovely gag at the expense of that. Not Quark, not Rom. What's his name? Nog's looking through the history boot that Bashir gives him.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a picture of Gabriel Bell from past tense. And he says, this guy looks like Commander Sisko. And Quark just dismisses him with all humans look alike. That was a fantastic gag.
Thankfully, we didn't revisit the hippies from past tense.
But speaking of hippies, wasn't Charles Napier a hippie in the original?
He was Adam.
Yeah, he was Adam in...
The Way to Eden, brother.
We reach, brother.
Not one of my favorite episodes.
No.
He was singing... Remember?
And dancing in the rain.
He was playing the space guitar, whatever that was.
The space sitar.
What was like his leader? It was the guy with the big ears, like Enoch or something? I can't remember.
I can't remember. Is it Dr. Severin? Was that him?
Oh, yeah, maybe it was, yeah.
I don't remember. I can't say I've watched The Way to Eden a lot.
No, I haven't either, but yeah. I do remember that one. That Spock's jamming on his little Vulcan.
His leer.
Yeah.
I am not a merry man.
Well, I like the nods to all the little things from the past. The Roswell incident, the Hangar 18.
Weather balloon.
The weather balloon.
Mm-hmm.
None of this ever happened. It's just a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. It's a great... It's like The Trouble with Tribbles. It's a fun comedy episode that has a little bit of a nod here and there, but nothing... Nothing really serious about this one comes back, does it, as far as I remember?
No, but it's nice to finally get that Cousin Galen plot resolved that we've been hearing about. Galen owes me this. He owes me a ship. Well, you got your ship, and your cousin tried to kill you.
See, I don't understand that, honestly. I could see where his cousin would send him a substandard ship that just would break down on him. But I'm not sure why his cousin would actually try to kill him. They probably should have thrown something in there where that's kind of a partial debt payment or something, where he'd have a motivation to kill him so that he wouldn't have to pay the rest of it.
Well, I'm just going to, you know, you could give me a no prize for this. What if Gala knew about Quark's mother's dealings and profit making, and wanted to eliminate Quark to try to get close to his aunt, right? That would be
That would be fine, but it's something else they could have written in, maybe.
Yeah,
you know,
he was just tired of freaking Quark, and he's like, fine, you know, he's like, great, yeah, I'm gonna give you a ship. He's gonna love it, and then the first time he uses it, he's gonna just disappear into nothing, go in the warp until the ship just destroys itself.
They make it sound as if he's just putting him in there because, you know, putting or making the death attempts, or the murder attempt, just because he doesn't like him. And it just, that doesn't seem like the proper motivation for a Ferengi. The motivation should be some sort of financial gain. So your speculation about his aunt would work. The fact that he would owe him more money that he'd have to pay back if he was still alive works also. Mm-hmm. But they didn't really give him any motivation except for dislike.
Maybe
he just didn't like him.
Yeah, but that's not a good Ferengi motivation to me.
See, I took it as the cousin was, felt Quark was holding it over him almost, even if it was all paid off. Just remember, you got your start because of me. And that's why he wanted him gone.
Again, then that goes to pride, and that doesn't strike me as good enough. I'm not saying you're wrong in your interpretation of the motivation, because I think that's what they give you. But I'm just thinking, as written, it doesn't really seem like a proper Ferengi motivation.
Yeah, but there's been Ferengi that have been motivated by other things than... Like in the next gen, the one that had the grudge against Picard for years and did all that stuff, and, you know, and the way that they kind of undid him was that they turned his crew against him because he was, you know, what he's doing is not profitable. You know, I mean, you can have Ferengi. He's just a messed up Ferengi. You know, he's...
Yeah, but I think having a messed up Ferengi isn't good enough. They should do better than that. They should write it better. Mm-hmm. We're definitely picking at a nit here, because this is a pretty minor plot point as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But I think it would have just been better if... cheated him by giving him a ship that was, you know, definitely substandard, and somehow he hid the fact that it was substandard. But then you have to explain, why didn't Rom see that before they left?
Well, because they didn't.
He would have examined the ship and, you know, and inspected it and made sure everything was.
Yeah, but he says that I wouldn't see it because it wasn't, you know, it's like with something in the programming that it wouldn't kick in until it. First time you went into warp.
Yeah, that was the booby trap that they had set.
Right.
I'm saying it would have made more sense somehow if it could have been, not that he booby trapped it, but that he gave him something that was substandard. That, you know, it should have been, you know, whatever, by, you know, it should have been a ship worth,
but see, that's what
200
was
bars
expecting.
Of platinum, but because it's substandard, it's not, yeah. And that's the problem to explain that away, because he would have Rom inspect the ship and he would find something substandard, because Rom is an excellent engineer. So you have a story hole there, too. But I'm thinking, motivation-wise,
like
that would make more sense.
It would have been better for them to find something substandard so that they wouldn't even suspect that there was a booby trap. Like, purposely put something substandard in so that Rom would find that, and then they wouldn't suspect, you know, that
well,
it's...
Well, like, my point is that the booby trap itself is kind of an unexplained thing. Why would he do that? Where's the profit for his cousin by booby trapping it? If anything, it costs him more to booby trap it.
Where does the term booby come from in booby trap?
I don't know. We'll leave that one to you to look up.
I'll do that while you guys talk.
I mean, does my point make sense or no?
No, it makes sense, yes.
And again, I understand I'm picking at a nit here. And
it needed something to clarify his motivations to have it relate to profit specifically.
Right now it seems like the motivation is, well, we needed something to happen to send them back in time.
Hmm. Which is pretty much the truth.
Yeah, but...
Yeah.
But that's the problem.
Yeah.
Pajamas purchased by Rom at the start of the episode seem to be the same shirt worn by Sovak, also played by Max Grodnicki, in the Next Generation's third season episode, Captain's Holiday. That's an interesting little tidbit.
Yeah, interesting piece of wardrobe department. I wonder if that was an accident.
I don't think it was an accident, but I think they hope no one would notice, is my guess.
Or if they did notice, they could always just play off as an in-joke, can't they?
So they do point out in the trivia bits, Avery Brooks has only two lines in this episode, which just brings to mind that, you know, the last episode he was basically in a coma, and this episode he only has two lines. So right now we have not been focusing on Captain Sisko very much.
No, he comes back, doesn't he?
Yeah.
No, they're going to write him out.
Yeah.
They're going to kill him off at the end of season three.
I think it speaks to the strength of the ensemble cast, though, that your prime character can be limited not only in an episode, but in consecutive episodes in order to focus on the ensemble.
That was always the strength of this program. That's why I like this one in particular so much, the series.
Well, I think top to bottom, this is the best Star Trek cast. I mean, people will argue the original series, but I think this is a larger cast, and the original series didn't really do a true ensemble until they got to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it
was Kirk, Spock, McCoy. You know, everybody else had their moments, but they were backup players. They were not part of an ensemble. They didn't focus on them the way they do on this series.
Right, and never had a Sulu-centric episode. Maybe you have had some Sulu Scotty moments. One, you know, where he was kind of a player.
Like, yeah, well, you have the what's it called, Wolf in the Fold is a Scotty-centric.
And then the ones with the lights of Zinyar or whatever.
Zetar,
yeah. I don't think anybody
How's your booby trap focus going?
Oh, okay. The Spanish word bobo translates to stupid, daft, naive, simple, fool, idiot, clown, funny man, one who is easily cheated, and similar pejorative terms. The slang of bobo, booby, translates to dunce. Variations of this word exist in other languages, such as Latin, with their meaning being to stammer. Thus, the term booby trap gives... Suddenly, I became Christopher Walken. Gives
That's
rise
what I was just
to
thinking.
The booby trap gives rise to the idea that an individual with the misfortune to be caught in the trap does so because the individual is a booby, or that an individual who is caught in the trap thereby becomes a booby. That wasn't my best Christopher Walken, but it's early. So that's where the term booby is. So you're a dummy because you fell in a trap.
Trap made for a dummy.
Now you know, and knowing is half the battle.
And I am the booby host.
The only other trivia I've got on this is the pin-up calendar in the army base has Has Wings and Careers Done It, which is the poem that Gary Mitchell quotes in Where No Man Has Gone Before.
My love
has wings, slender feathered things.
Kind of a cool flashback.
Was that supposed to be Rita Hayworth on the calendar? Or just...
In the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, but it may have been close enough that they didn't have to pay any royalties.
The Star Trek Redemption? The Aurora Pente Redemption. There you go.
Okay,
we're nothing else, because this was
terrible. This is going to be a really short episode.
We've got a long email.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Well, we have an email from our friend Blaine. Yes, Blaine. It's an email from Blaine.
Maybe Blaine will give us some more to chew on.
Blaine says, "Hi, guys. Once again, when they want to go for straight-up comedy, they give us a Ferengi episode. It's arguably the best Ferengi episode, but it would be nice if they could successfully mine another comedic well. I guess we'll have to wait, say, 24 more episodes for that. It's a lot of fun and definitely something to look that took effort and planning given the sheer number of new locations. This is one of the few episodes that is really just a one-off for the season. I like seeing Charles Napier again, best known for playing all sorts of hard-ass authoritarian figures, typically a high-ranking military official of some sort, also played the hippie Adam in The Way of Eden from the original series. We see Nog and Rom with chances to shine and get some nice commentary on human habits as well. It's a fun one to be sure, although some of the humor seems a bit forced. It definitely passes Paul's channel surfing test. Blame. Oh, it absolutely passes my channel surfing test. I think this is a high-quality episode. I wasn't bothered by the fact that the Ferengi are mainly... Yes, 11. I wasn't bothered by the fact that the Ferengi are mainly mined for comedy purposes. I think that's the function they've fallen into. Comedy with a little bit of depth on some of the main characters, but that's about it. Yes. And... But I don't see that as a negative, to be quite honest with you. I think that's where they found their niche. I think when they tried to make them into, a viable threat in TNG, they fell on their faces. So, you know, this works for them.
Yeah, I think so, because they weren't a credible enemy, because nobody really took them seriously. So what they've done with them in Deep Space Nine is give them enough depth as characters to be likable and believable, but they're still good comic adept characters when they need to be. But and I don't think in this one, I don't think Quark's played for comedy. I think his reaction to what's going on around him is what makes it funny.
And I think that, and I think just the circumstances, for them to actually end up at Roswell, and for that to be part of the 1950s Martian craze, I just think that's clever. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they're necessarily comic foils, except, you know, when they're jumping up and down, hitting themselves in the head and stuff.
Well,
or even Quark's machinations to basically take over the planet. You know, I think there's some comedy mind there, but I think they play it serious just the same, which is, I think, the right way to play a comedy like this. You play it serious and let the circumstances be the humor.
So two things about the Universal Translator. One is kind of funny. One is like kind of dark. All right, so I guess the Universal Translator will also make your... So you're saying a certain word, but it comes out something that the other person can understand, but yet your lips match. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's your point?
Well, I guess we'll let that go, because it'd be too hard to try to like make everybody's lips not match up to what they're saying. Yeah, then it would look like
a bad Japanese dubbed movie.
Bad dubbed movie. But the other thing that I thought was kind of dark is like, well, it's like suddenly I'm a 16-year-old girl. Is that everybody in the future has a small device embedded in their head?
I think that's all they're saying is that that's where the Ferengi have it. I don't think necessarily the other races do that. They might do their own thing. The humans might have it as part of their badge on their uniform or something. I don't know.
Could be, maybe. But then somebody's got some type of, the comm badge you could take off. But if you've got one like a subdermal implant, people could track you wherever you go just by that.
Could.
Little shiftiness, little darkness in the future. I don't think I want a universal translator embedded in me.
A little bit of Black Ops going on.
That's right.
You know, I think when I read the novelization of Star Trek The Motion Picture 1,000 years ago, mm-hmm. Kirk says something at one point about having an implant so they can track him.
Yes, he does. You're absolutely right, yeah.
Oh, thank God the mind is still there partially.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, that's in the boot. Yeah, that they can track them at all times. Oh yeah, well remembered. And also a little bit skeevy that they can do that.
Oh, the Admiral's blood pressure is up. We need to go to. Oh my God!
He goes back in time to rescue whales, and he brings back a woman half his age, and this is what he's up to. How Gary Kirk.
And he's got a whale in there, too. Oh, my God. That's whale forget me. They call the police.
And she's pregnant.
They are not the hell your whales.
What are you doing in the tank, Jim? Smoking a cigarette?
So's the whale. Oh! Shame, shame, shame. Yeah, so there we have three aliens, which some of the, I guess the Roswell lore is that there was three aliens in the ship, so it's nice that they, you know, we conveniently have three Ferengi for everything to match up. So, yeah, it was all in all good. We didn't really talk too much about Megan Gallagher, did we? I mean, other than she's hot, she's cute, she's hot.
Yep. No, she's great in the part. She's adorable and she does all the right things.
Well, one of the notes I saw that's on the just below the synopsis says the producers requested a Megan Gallagher type for one of the roles in the episode. Upon hearing this, Gallagher's agent contacted them and said Gallagher might be able to do it herself. So there you go. She had previously appeared in the second season episode Invasive Procedures, which I don't remember what that was about.
Wolfhand, I don't either.
Unjoined Trill, Heckling, okay. Anyway, and then she will also appear later on in Star Trek Voyager, Body and Soul, and she was the wife on Millennium to Lance Hendrick, who unfortunately she meets a end at one of the seasons. A rather messy end as well.
I liked how Quark kind of had the upper hand in the beginning, so to speak, until he got too big for his britches.
Until he said the Russian word. Yeah, and then they're kind of like, yeah, you're about to be dissected now, Quark.
Yeah. And what dealings do you have with the Russians?
Yeah. Mistake. And they made reference to the president. What was that? Eisenhower at the time.
Truman.
Yeah. They made. Yeah. I think that was kind of well done, and they didn't overemphasize it. But you have Napier's character. You know, Democrat. Blah, blah, blah,
yeah.
He's not as stupid as he looks.
I thought that was kind of well done because I think it fit the grumpy character that he was playing.
I think it kind of fit the times too, to be honest. 1947, there was a little fatigue with the political system, so I think it fit in.
Fatigue in a political system? No. Actually, I just coined a new word. Platigue.
Political fatigue.
Fatigue. We need to make that a thing.
I've got fatigue.
You got fatigue. I'm fed up with your political fatigue bullshit on Facebook.
There we go. Let's start it today.
Anyway, we're rating this one.
I guess it's about time to rate it. And I thought this was a solid episode. We're on a scale of up to 5. I do not think it is a 5. I don't think it's a perfect episode. I don't think it has the epic feel of a perfect episode. But I think it's really a really well self-contained episode with humor, with science fiction, with very little to pick away at, I thought, from a negative end. So I'm going to give this a 4. I think this was a very enjoyable show.
I completely agree with you. 4 stars. It's very fun. It's very enjoyable. It passes the Spataro Flick test.
I'm going to go with a 4.25.
Is that the Charles Napier 2.5?
Yes.
Or 0.25?
The 0.25 is for Mr. Napier. I'm going to give it a 4.25 Good Old Boys Blues Brothers Band things.
They have country and western. David?
I'm going all the way out. I love this episode. This is my favorite. Charles Napier from BJ and the Bear. This is a 5. I love it. I could watch this one over and over again.
Fair enough.
All right, I guess that's it for Little Green Men. We have a little bit of a short episode, but
oh, Andy, fun just the same. Did you know that Charles Napier taught art at a high school, at a junior high school in Clearwater, Florida?
I did not know that.
Which you've been to. Well, not to the high school, but you've been to
the high school. I've not been to the high school.
No. In fact, he was part of he was in that class.
I was in that class. I know he took over the growls after Ted Cassidy died on The Incredible Hulk.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Charles Napier did the last couple of seasons because Ted Cassidy passed away.
So you're saying Charles Napier killed Ted Cassidy?
Yeah, to get his job of going.
There you go. Did he get paid a flat rate or per growl?
Now that Charles Napier has passed away, sadly, if they do want to get a new growl for the Hulk, I think we know where they can look.
And then are they going to use Pee Wee Herman as the body double to match those growls? Ooh, I'm sorry. Sorry, Andy, I'm just not seeing it.
Anyway, now that I've been thoroughly dissed by my friend.
So, if you can't be dissed by your friends, who can you be dissed by?
That's a very good point, yeah.
With that being it for Little Green Men, where will we find ourselves in 2 weeks?
Next time on an all-new episode. Actually, I need to... What is the episode?
Wait. Don't we have an email?
Oh, yeah, we have an email.
We have an email.
Jeez.
Who's going to read the email?
Read the email.
Is it in anybody's contract?
I am contractually obliged to read the email, as we have discussed, if I don't do anything else in the episode.
You really did nothing else except for imitate the Hulk.
Yeah, and I did bugger all in this one, so I let the guest pick up my slack. Because that is in my contract as well. If we have a guest, he does all my work for me. Do you not read my contract, lawyer boy?
It seems to change. Show
read
to
it.
Show.
I wrote it for you.
I love that Paul put the "and any other amendments or additions that may be deemed responsible by Andrew at any point
during the show."
I can change it mid-show. You do know that, Bill.
Uh huh. That's why I'm wearing this kimono.
Well, next week I want you to wear the purple wig.
Again.
Yep.
Just do that quietly and don't complain, Bill, because he might get you wearing a sumo outfit in 2 more weeks.
It's my revenge for all those Hulk dissings you just did.
Whoops.
Anyway, we do have an email. It's just called Bunch of Thoughts. It's by Chip Mullins. Hello, Chip. Hello, gentlemen. First of all, I have to say I'm excited that you are doing readings from A Stitch in Time. I wouldn't get too excited at the minute, Chip, which I wanted to get after hearing you all mention it, but I don't own a Kindle and the book is a little too expensive. Maybe I'll ask for it as a birthday or Christmas present. As of writing this, you all just released Family Business, so you haven't got too far into the book yet. I look forward to hearing more. This email is going to be a catch-up over several episodes. Improbable Cause and The Die Is Cast are two of my favourite episodes, mainly to see Odo Garrick and one of my favourite side characters, Enebrin Tane. You all mentioned this wasn't the last time we see Tane, but I definitely don't remember when he comes back, so I'm resisting looking for it online and I will wait. My two dislikes for these episodes were Odo's reveal he wanted to be with his people. Duh. So he left it out of his official report. I thought it was pretty obvious that he wanted to be his people, and therefore not much of a reveal. The other nitpick is during the battle sequence. There is a shot of 3 Cardassian Kelvin ships in formation, just static. Have I skipped a line there? No, I haven't. Sorry, I'll say that again. The other nitpick is during the battle sequence. There is a shot of 3 Cardassian Kelvin ships in formation, just static. Not doing anything, not moving, not firing, nothing. In an all-out fight, those ships would be flirting everywhere or running back to the wormhole, which I would have done if I were the captain. I understand this episode was CGI heavy, but if you're going to do it, you're going to do something. Family Business so far is probably one of my favourite Ferengi episodes because, as you all described, it delves so much further into the Ferengi culture. I agree with Ambit, which I think we should all have on t-shirts, that the show wasn't trying to make a commentary on the real-life state of women. I think they were laying the groundwork for how the Ferengi culture is going to go through the series. One quick correction here. All right. You made me laugh out loud in your discussion about the Gorn and baseball. I think Bill said something about, in the episode The Neutral Zone on The Next Generation, the character of Offenhaus helps the Enterprise negotiate with the Gorn. It was the Romulans and Malak Alamo's first credited appearance on Star Trek. Also, in the game Star Trek Online, the Klingons have conquered the Gorn, which would explain why Cestus III is Federation again. No canon I could find to back this up, though. Since you all record way in advance of release, I'm going to continue, but if I get to a point where you haven't recorded, you can save those thoughts for that episode and not spoil any first-time viewers. The Way of the Warrior and Return to Grace made me lose a lot of the luster that the Klingons are amazing warriors. They're just kind of silly in The Way of the Warrior, when Garak and Dukat are just piling up bodies. Just too easy to take out Klingon warriors. In The Visitor and The Muse, I like how writers kept a little continuity of Jake's first novel being Anslem. I didn't catch that the first time I watched the series. And then we've not done the rest of them yet, have we?
Yeah, he mentions two other episodes that we haven't covered yet, so I'd kind of like to hold this until we get to them. But I'd say jump beyond those two paragraphs, maybe.
If you'll permit me one production request, I have for Paul to somehow record louder. A lot of the times when I'm listening to the podcast, Bill and Andy come out just fine. But whenever Paul speaks, I have to turn the volume up substantially to make out what he's saying. And then Andy laughs and my eardrum splits. Nothing against Andy laughing, it's just really loud when I turn the volume up to hear Paul. I find myself regularly adjusting the volume knob during episodes. Well, you don't want to play with your knob during episodes, do you? Other than that, love the podcast and keep up the good work. Will you be doing any kind of coverage on Star Trek Discovery once it airs? Thank you for your time in reading this, Chip in Washington, D.C. No, thank you, Chip, for taking the time to email us such a long and interesting email. I do not wish to speak for my illustrious colleagues, but I'm going to. I'm pretty sure we'll do something on Star Trek Discovery, if only the pilot.
Yeah, I'm sure we will as well. As far as the production goes, there are some issues with the Skype and the Skype recorder. This is certainly nothing intentional that my volume kind of fades on things. And I've had a little bit of difficulty working it all out. Sometimes it just records at a lower level, and I've kind of figured out how to deal with that. Other times, for reasons that totally escape me, in the middle of a sentence, the volume will just kind of fade out. I have no idea why that happens, and I'm trying my best to work with that. Like I said, the first one, I think I've kind of figured out production ways to kind of deal with it. But the second one, I'm still working on, and I apologize to anybody who's having trouble hearing my gems of thoughts that I give.
The pearls of wisdom that emanate forth from your vocal arena.
Your gem Hadar thoughts? Yeah, okay.
The dulcet tones.
The dulcet tones of Paul.
Yeah. Part of the process, not to get too into production, is part of the process has become, instead of making one recording, having it split up separately where my recording is separate from the other guy, so that I can just raise the volume on mine without raising the volume on them to kind of level it off. Again, like I said, that solves that problem, but it doesn't solve the problem of the fade out that occurs. And I think it's all a conspiracy thing on the part of Skype and Skype recorders to get you to stop using their free software and pay for stuff. And if anybody out there listening says, hey, I found the perfect recording software and I'm willing to pay for it for you, that's, you know, I'm listening.
That last bit's crucial.
You know, this is just a hobby, and I try not to invest too much financially into it because I'm already investing a lot of my time. So, that's what it is. But thanks, Chip. I really do appreciate your email and your insights into the shows and your commentary on the recording. I'm interested in people giving us both. I am also interested, and I'm asking people to please do it, in getting as many iTunes reviews out there as we can, because as much as we do this for fun and as an excuse for us to get together periodically and just talk, I would really enjoy to know that it's getting out to a lot of listeners, and I'm not sure if it is or isn't, But the one way I know that it does start to get out to listeners is if we get iTunes reviews. So if people who have not given us reviews could start to do so, it would really help us. And it would be very, very much appreciated. In the meanwhile, what are we doing in 2 weeks?
Next time, our all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets. Worf, Dax, and a revered Klingon Dehar master, Kor, search for the Sword of Carlos.
Glorious.
It can unite an empire.
Now it is time for us to reclaim what is ours.
A weapon of legend, the Sword of Kalos. When its power seduces Worf, I hold it in my hands. Will he use it to lead his people?
To turn would change Klingon history.
Or destroy them.
With a sword in my hand, I'll be leading the Empire.
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Kabla!